The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of Take Two. And because Greg Hughes has ditched us to run for election, we have a seat we get to fill with exciting conservative Republicans in the great state of Utah. And joining us today is Candace Perucci. Am I saying it right? Because every time I say it, I'm like, just say it fast and hope it's correct.
Great job.
Excellent. And Mara Carabello's here. So we have just ladies' hour today.
I know,
so
it's going to be good.
Thanks for being here. So Candace, for people who don't know a lot about you, because you're still new-ish, tell us a few fun facts about yourself we should know.
Well, I represent House District 49, which is the Harriman and Riverton area. I won a special election in 2019. And so been in for a bit, got in time just in time for COVID, which has been exciting since then. So I grew up in my district, actually, went to Harriman Elementary. And my family, we love that area, so that's why my husband and I decided to raise our family there. I've got a little boy who's 4 and a little girl on the way. And when I am not up at the Capitol and I'm working on that policy making, I'm an adjunct professor down at UVU. And I love Disneyland and traveling, so we like to take lots of trips as a family.
All right, so between the Capitol and UVU, you put the miles on your car.
Definitely, yeah.
Excellent. And people who don't know who the Ixoro Group and Mara is, aside from the fact that they love you and listen to you every week, what should they know about Mara Carabello?
I don't have any fun facts.
You don't?
Well,
wait, can I hear you properly?
No.
We're having mic problems in
now
here.
Okay, now that's me. Now I can hear me.
Okay, Mara's here. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
Woo. So, Ixoro's been around for almost 21 years. That's not a fun fact. That's astonishing because I haven't felt very deliberate about Ixoro. So now I'm like, what just happened?
You are a boss woman. So when was the 20th anniversary?
Well, we didn't celebrate it very well, so there's a chance I'm going to pretend it hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
But it was a couple of years ago. But as you know, everybody likes to celebrate the 22nd anniversary.
Yeah.
I think that's always a really big deal. The 20th is overdone.
Yeah.
But so 2002 is when we started Ixoro.
And wild.
It was a rare, like, we were a bipartisan firm, and nobody understood that, and they were all super suspicious of, like, who are you? And we're not really lobbyists and we're not, but we wanted to stay in the public space. And so, you know, I think now, I hope we're in a good public policy kind of practical space. So it's been over 20 years though.
That's
what's
awesome.
Crazy.
I know.
Yeah.
You're kind of like the Hannah Waddingham of Ixoro Group.
Okay,
you're the
so
boss babe.
Know.
You don't know that? You don't watch Ted Lasso?
Yeah. Oh, is that her name?
Super fashionable and super awesome. Is that her name?
Really
I may be making this up.
I didn't
I'm
know
really
who
bad
it was
at names, but I do love Ted Lasso.
I shouldn't admit that I know these things or even that I like the show because my mom, this is random, but my brother the other day was like, hey, our other sister told mom or asked mom something about what she's watching. And she's like, well, Heidi loves Ted Lasso, so I'm going to start watching it. And if you know my mom, she's 72. She is like very conservative in all things just life. I'm not talking Republican, Democrat, but like when we were growing up, the only way you could ever watch TV, it was like PBS or maybe the news. And as if you were like folding laundry or ironing or accomplishing something at the same time. She didn't watch frivolous things. She doesn't like naughty words. And I'm like, ooh.
And that's
I'm
when like, you don't notice it when you're watching it. And then you picture either your kids or your parents and you're like, oh, there's a lot of F words.
There are a lot of F words in there. And I noticed because I've been watching it with my teenage son. So I'm sorry I watched this and I need to talk
it's
to my mom about
though.
Not watching it.
It's kind of good.
I know. It's the most feel good show with some wankers and F words in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's British, so it's okay, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, they can say those horrible words. And you're like, isn't that quaint?
All right. Well, you're still my Hannah Waddingham. Anyone
well,
who watches
you.
Ted Lasso Thanks. Knows. Okay. So I keep coming in here on Fridays and thinking that we're going to have the Supreme Court ruling coming in on student loans because we know that someone's going to be disappointed and there's going to be stuff to talk about, but they keep not ruling on it. I don't know if it's their big drop this year and they want to wait until they're done and just say, this is the last thing, shut the doors and like run home. But It's not there. Candace, you were saying, though, that you think a couple of the decisions, or at least one of them that came out today, might be a signal towards what's going to happen.
And that was just, I was just reading a Forbes article because I've been waiting to see if this decision comes out. But they felt like the case that dealt specifically with immigration may have been signaling where the court's going to be at, and that they wouldn't be in favor of President Biden's loan forgiveness plan. I know the big question with this is, can a U.S. president even do this? With what authority is he coming at this to be able to say, we're going to forgive $10,000 or $20,000 of your student loans? And I know the hook they're trying to use is the 2003 HEROES Act that gave the Secretary of Education some ability to adjust how loan payments worked. But the court's going to be looking at if Congress in 2003 really intended for it to go this far, and whether this is something that a president has the ability to do. So hopefully we see it come out in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, the immigration ruling was interesting. One, because it was an 8-1 ruling. And I like to see this court.
You like consensus.
Well, I like that this court has had 2 or 3 5-4s, mm-hmm. but now they have an 8-1, which indicates where I think we need to continue to be with the Supreme Court, which is they're not a partisan organization. Now, again, they have judicial approaches that somewhat may predict what they're going to do, but they're looking at precedents. In this instance, it was interesting because they did rule with the Biden administration, mm-hmm. and they said that Texas and Louisiana particularly didn't have standing on the issue, and that Congress, in fact, could remedy themselves. So why is the federal government is not at harm here? They could remedy themselves. So it was interesting, but I'd like to see the 8-1. And then the other boring but may affect Utah decision was the Navajo Nation had taken their prescriptive right to the Colorado River to the Supreme Court, in which, in this instance, they ruled somewhat against the nation as part of that ruling, and it was a close ruling. Gorsuch, who is a justice from Colorado, mm-hmm. Vehemently defended sort of the nation in the minority opinion. But why we may care about it is, in the majority opinion, they sort of alluded to this notion that if the Navajos wanted to litigate their share, they could. Prior, they've been discouraged. So why do we care? Well, if the Navajos assert litigation, then Utah is part of that who gets what share. And as we all know, since the drought from a couple of years ago, the question of who gets what share of the Colorado is a big deal. So this will come back to Utah in the form of a Colorado River negotiation. Yeah.
And it's interesting in light of the case we were talking about last week, where with Navajo adoptions, they wanted to put the right back on Navajo families first. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it's kind of interesting watching. And I'm trying to think, are there any other big cases other than student loans at this point, or is that all we're expecting? I know they have one day on the calendar next week, so.
Oh, no, see, they have others, and now I can't, of course, yeah. remember them. The thing with the Supreme Court is all of them are significant. It's just like which ones are interesting.
Who they're significant. Yeah, who they're significant
to. And the number of yeah. impacts.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. So, okay, so well, we will wait another week or two and see exactly what happens there. Here in Utah, all the excitement is around the fervor of this CD2 race, which is happening at a super fast pace because I think everyone's like, well, it's 3 months away, but we all know it's not really 3 months away. Did either of you watch either debate?
If I'm outing myself, I tried. I got a little bored.
It was a
they
lot.
They had a hard time with streaming. I know they yeah. had to switch platforms, and they split it because there's 13 candidates. They had 2 debates. So I was following on Twitter, like the
okay, that was the smart
I
way to do it.
Generally follow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was long, and it mm-hmm. started late, too.
And to everyone's credit, most of them are sort of centrist, true Republicans, so there's not a ton of definition between sort of what you'd express as yeah. your, but you are choosing personality and you're choosing an approach and a communication style. I mean, all of what they're expressing. The other thing that happened this week that I don't think generally matters, the more general the election gets, the less I think endorsements matter. Mm-hmm. But for sort of inside baseball stuff, where party activists and delegates know each other really well, endorsements may be more persuasive because they all, they kind of know the endorser sometimes very personally.
Which might differentiate someone,
It makes a bigger deal. And we saw several high-profile endorsements in the last couple of days. And so
Chris
Stewart
was this week, too, endorsing
Celeste Malloy. Yeah.
And I don't think that she's probably a name brand that a lot of people know, so that probably makes a difference to people saying, okay, well, this was his seat and she's running. Will it make a difference?
She's really well-known. So I used to work for Congressman Stewart, and she's worked for the congressman, obviously. She is really well known in the rural communities and in southern Utah. She's been a fierce fighter on public lands and is incredibly brilliant. But I think, to your point, it was a big deal that Congressman Stewart, one, endorsed someone and that he had endorsed Celeste. I think that I also saw John Dougal endorse Jordan Hess as the other endorsement I'd seen.
I heard someone mention that he was endorsed, and I couldn't figure out who was saying it.
And so. Jordan Hess is another interesting figure in which I doubt the average Republican voter may know him, but the delegates know him well because he's been a party leader for a while. So, and it's in Delta, Utah. And who doesn't love Delta? And they did a good job doing it in the middle. But
they're
trying
to split the difference. But it's like, who's going
to be there?
It's
a couple of hours from tip to toe. So, like, if you lived at the top of the district, it's probably 2.5-3 hours to Delta. And if you lived in St. George, it's probably 3 hours to Delta. So who shows up?
I think they're going to have high turnout because of the concentration of effort by candidates to get people there and what's on the line. I mean, to be able to vote in this kind of environment when a congressman has resigned. I am hoping attendance is higher than people are expecting. And I do think, to go back on endorsements, I think that when it's in such a consolidated time frame, endorsements do matter more because you're now relying on someone you trust and their judgment when they're making an endorsement. Whereas if when you have like a full year when you're running, I think people forget those. You know, drop it. So I don't know. We'll have to see how that plays into it. I do think that there are obviously a lot of candidates, but for the delegates, they're going to be looking at who also registered to get signatures, which I think will have a huge impact. And in my mind, it's down to Celeste, Jordan, and Greg, just from what I've heard coming out of tomorrow, out of the delegates.
And as we said last week, I think, Kenneth, you were saying this earlier. Remember, convention, the parties decided to only have one person come out of convention. So that'll be interesting. The other thing I think I will say they did really well, particularly even for seasoned delegates, they have been broadcasting so clearly, like, guys, we are not messing around. There is no party business. You show up, you start to vote. And if you are a seasoned delegate, you still know the length of time that could be committed to party work. And they have been so clear that this is a special election. There will be no party work. We will show up and we will start voting. And I think that actually is a really enticing
thing. It should increase turnout.
Right,
I think
exactly.
If they did that every time, you would increase turnout.
it's a long day.
Last convention, it was 3 or 4 hours before we actually got to the agenda.
And by then, your spouse is calling, and the family thing you thought you could get to is now a half an hour away. And, like, you can't. Right. And so I do think they've been really smart to telecast, hey, listen, we're not messing around. We'll start voting when you show up, and we will keep voting until we're down.
And they have to vote only till they get to 50%, right? That's their...
No.
So that's what's interesting. And when we passed this, the party was willing to go with this process of just one candidate who... You have to get the threshold.
So you need 60 out. Or?
No, they're not even holding them to 60%.
It will be the highest vote getter at the end of the round.
Yeah. Okay.
But I do think with that many candidates, you're going to go through multiple rounds, right?
For sure.
So they'll
drop off a couple. They've been a little nondescript about how many. I think there might even be maybe in the early rounds a threshold that they announce. Mm-hmm. And to get through a few rounds quickly. And then what becomes super fun to watch, so if members of the press are there. What's fun to watch is if you're in position 3 or 4, you've got some leverage because now you have enough people that you could be the kingmaker, right? You could be the one that puts someone else over the top. And so if you like inside baseball, these multi-candidate conventions are pretty interesting to watch.
And you're working with other candidates. You want to maintain a friendly relationship, right? Because at some point you're going to be asking them for their endorsement. And so campaigns that get nasty in a hurry, I'm like, you're not going to get pick up their support in that third, fourth, fifth round of voting.
So, and there's always another race that comes around before you know it, or a surprise, something like this, yeah. Which is interesting. I don't think we can count on Remy Cush getting any votes because I understand that he didn't show up to the debates.
Yeah.
And then is also getting signatures,
which
is a lot of work if you're not going to show up to the debates.
Yeah, that was surprising. I think it's Becky Edwards, Bruce Huff.
Yep.
I'm trying to remember.
Scott Hatfield.
Yes.
Scott Reber and then Remy who are doing the signatures. So it'll be interesting to see. And also on the United Utah Party side, January Walker is collecting signatures too. So, the interesting thing is the three people you named when we're talking about it, those, you know, are going to be the top vote getters probably tomorrow, but it'll be interesting to see. I was half listening to the debate while doing other things last night because, like you said, it got so long. But I remember one of them who got up and he was saying something about delegates, please answer my calls. And delegates are probably inundated right now, too, when you think about the fact that there's 13 candidates calling you and you're like, I only have so many hours in a day, I still have a job. So I know they all have their work cut out for them before tomorrow to make sure that they get their word in edgewise, which is kind of interesting.
Which is where I think endorsements, again, there's less amount of time, fewer events for delegates to interact with them. Mm-hmm. And I think, to your point, Jordan Hess, he has been elected as the vice chair of the party before. Greg Hughes is well known as the former speaker and then a gubernatorial candidate. And then Celeste, I think, just Congressman Stewart's endorsement. We'll see how much that carries. Mm-hmm. I do think we did see Becky Edwards has run before, right? And I think she's definitely much more moderate and certainly much more moderate than delegates. And so it's interesting to me she did signatures and the delegate route.
And again, it was interesting that she switched.
She added that.
I don't know if that was a little bit of weird where you're like, oh, Becky, you kind of admitted that you maybe did this the wrong way.
So what did she do? I missed
out on this. When you file, you have to just tell the elections office what you're doing.
Yeah.
And she filed for signatures and no convention.
Oh.
And then she came back and
she was like, oh, whoops. She amended her filing. And I think it's probably 7,000 signatures is hard to get in like a consolidated period of time. And I don't know if it was like a Hail Mary where like at least then you're in the competition. But I do think people who got the signatures and are doing the convention route, I'm always a little perplexed because generally speaking,
it's a black mark on your convention.
And people can overcome it. Senator Lee collects signatures, right? Yeah. But most delegates, it rubs them the wrong way.
Well, and particularly incumbents, I think, can do both.
Right.
I think I don't know why, but there's something about like an incumbent just saying, hey, listen, I'm doing the whole process. This is like the epitome of grassroots informed politic. And I don't think you have the luxury of not. It's a big indication of where your fealty lies.
And your trust.
And I think you could get away with it if you were an incumbent in a regular election. Because as you know, many of our elected Republicans get signatures and we don't think twice about it. This I felt like was an indication, a flag that they were saying, okay, I'm
it's like
signaling.
You're cheating on them. You've got a side chick or
a little
something.
Bit. You got a
little
side.
Bit. Yeah. I mean, and incumbents who do it well say, I'm doing this to drive people to caucus, right? Like you go out and collect signatures and tell them about caucus night and that messaging can work. But yeah, I was really surprised to see that. So
are you going to be there on Saturday?
I will not. I tomorrow morning have a parade in Harriman that I am in. I've got
nice.
So
fun.
I'm in the local and I'm not a delegate in CD2, but I will be following it closely.
Yeah, same. I don't know who we're sending yet from Channel 2, but we'll be down there. But I'm like, well, I need to go do something.
Road
that's,
trip
yeah.
to Delta.
Yeah, I know. Do they have a splash pad down there or anything fun, you know? So I don't see that happening. Hey, and before we move on from this, I just want to mention, I don't think I've heard from Chris Stewart since his official announcement, but he was on one of our newscasts with Brian Schnee yesterday and finally talked about a little bit about his wife and how she had the stroke a year ago and really wanting to be home with his family, which I think anyone who's in political circles kind of knows that's been going on, but it was maybe the first time that he'd talked about it publicly. So it was interesting to hear him say that and saying that he's accepting the curveballs of life. So wishing him and his family the best as this process plays on.
And I think, if I can just add, as someone who had worked for Congressman Stewart, I have a great deal of respect for him. He's incredibly down to earth. There's a story where they needed to fix a light bulb and they came and he was on his desk and they're like, Congressman, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm fixing a light bulb. They're like, you don't do that, get down. And he was one of the hardest working people you know, but he is so family oriented. And so someone had texted me after the story came out, and they're like, so what's the real story? I'm like, that's the story. His wife had a stroke. Back off. Like, he's trying to take care of his family, and I think it's commendable that he's prioritizing that, because it's a big sacrifice, and that's a big announcement to make, to resign, right?
Yeah.
And to not be able to finish your term. So best wishes to him and his wife, and I hope she has a quick recovery.
I think it says something to the world we live in, where you assume that if someone's resigning, they're doing it quick because there's this awful scandal that you're trying mm-hmm. to sidestep away from, which doesn't work because there's the internet now. So it's a weird world we live in. And speaking of a weird world, we keep talking about this, but it's every other week, it's back and forth. But officially, as of this week, you can check out a Bible if you go to a Davis County school, which I know as soon as school's back in, kids are going to rush to the library and read that Bible. But it is back in. You guys were talking about it while you were in session. And is this a lot of ado about nothing, where somebody's trying to, I don't know, push someone else's buttons because they're pushing yours, or what's going on here?
So I think it's part of a bigger discussion. I'm the chair of the House Education Committee, and we had an interim committee meeting just on curriculum transparency, parent engagement, and discussing sensitive materials in the classroom. That's where this decision, the initial decision, the Davis committee that was compiled by the district who reviewed the Bible said it violated that. But if you look at the actual law on sensitive materials, that's not what they were correlating it to. It was a policy within the district. And then the Davis School Board took a vote and overturned it. So it worked through the process. I think this is part of a bigger discussion that we'll continue to have. I do think there, if you look, they had over 60 books challenged. The Bible is just one of them, right, being highlighted. But hopefully people see that it worked through the process. And we're working on, this is something Representative Ivory has championed over the years. And our committee is, you know, working with him and others and looking at, is there any clarity that needs to be made in the law so that we don't have confusion on what the Utah code is, at the very least, when districts are interpreting it.
I am going to launch some criticism against the legislature in that I think that they, again, fell to the temptation of playing an oversized role. Davis County was going through the process, continued with the criticism of withdrawing the Bible. They continued to say, hey, we're not done with our process. Give us a second. And while it wasn't, I'm using the legislator as though they're one person. They're not. So I mean to add some texture to it. But we had several legislators who used their bully pulpit, which is their prerogative. But I wish they would respect and let local processes play out before they start being a part of that conversation, because at our best, the legislators sort of protect or guard in some ways or sort of support the federal process. They also really govern the local process, but I think they do it best when they provide a little space to the local processes. And I felt like, particularly on the cultural war part of this discussion, I think part of this discussion has some education policy, and part of it has some culture war policy or dog whistling there. And I thought they jumped in really fast and didn't show enough respect to Davis County and letting them have their local conversation the way they wanted to have it.
So, and of course, I'm going to push back a little bit, but the administrative rules held
committee
hearing.
That's okay, girls can fight.
That's right.
No. And we in the committee had already established before the initial Bible decision was made that we were going to be talking about curriculum transparency.
Right.
So, I would say jumping the gun would have been in our special session, throwing in a bill that mm-hmm. would have overturned their decision, but we didn't do that. And we said, no, they're mid-process, right? And their superintendent and board members were saying, we're still working through this. We're seeing what kinks we have in the process. I'll tell you, I know a lot of people don't listen to our interim hearings, but we had 5 school districts come talk about their implementation process and what they've done as they've reviewed the sensitive materials law that we passed. And it was fascinating to see how everyone's was just a little bit different. And then at the end, some of them were saying, we're probably going to do what they're doing, or we're going to implement this differently. So I think had we jumped in to, you know, in the middle of the process, run something, but we were going in and looking at what was being used in this case to get the Bible out and reviewing what that law actually said, which it's talking about material that's pornographic, right? And there's this bright line in code that we were discussing. So I would say we did let the process weigh out. You're always going to have people who comment on how someone else's process is going. But Davis, they did say when they came before our committee, you know, we're working on this actively, and then we're going to be reviewing the current policy and process we have in place. So we'll see what that looks like, and then what next session, if that brings any legislation.
Yeah, and I'd like to see none. I think we have a moment where our legislature is too prone to overreach into public spaces. And, I mean, from someone who isn't coming from the place that's applauding this book banning and is rather saying, I think I trust our teachers more actually than petitioning parents, which is not a widely held point of view, I understand, with the Republican caucus. And that voice will win the day, I understand that part. But again, I would like to see some more restraint from our legislative leaders and more of a propensity to hold accountable, but also give voice to the local elected.
One thing, that voice that I haven't heard, and I don't know if you've heard him in the meetings, but I was talking to a librarian last week, and I had a party at my house, and she happened to be one of the random guests. And she had an interesting insight into how books are procured and brought into libraries, mm-hmm. and who reads them and chooses them. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting, because you don't really think about it. But mm-hmm. there's one person probably at each school or the libraries or whatever, if you're talking about county teams, that are kind of picking off of lists, or some of them are good about reading them all themselves. So it's kind of an interesting process of how it works and how the books even end up in libraries.
And that came up in our discussion as well, yeah. is other districts have said, we're now trying to be proactive on the front end, because you can allow people to petition to remove a book all you want, but if you don't shut off the flow of, in this case, you know, pornographic material coming in, then you're constantly going to be playing catch up. And I do want to make it clear, we had teachers come in, we've had librarians come in, and when we put up on the board, because it's so, it makes people blush to actually read what the law, the definition of criminal porn, right, is, it's pretty dang clear, and that's why they call it the bright line rule. We're not talking about controversial topics. What the sensitive materials law that was passed is talking about things that are defined as porn, and so there's that conversation, and that's what we were highlighting in our committee discussion, and I think most people, and even the teachers we had there when we had that, the teacher said, no, I would absolutely not want that in my classroom. And when people reference like To Kill a Mockingbird or Fahrenheit 451, no one is trying to ban those books. At least in the conversations I've had and as we've worked on these policies, no one's trying to pull those books off the shelves, and that's not what our law does. I think there's a lot of misinformation about the law, and we, you know, in terms of how we message that, but need to make it clear what a sensitive material is.
So The Grapes of Wrath stays. I always hated the ending of that book. Yeah. Read it in junior high and you're like, What?
No, it's the bright line rule is straight up porn. And there are a lot of concerns with having that, obviously, in a K-12 setting and what's age appropriate for students.
All right. We'll let you disagree on this topic, but here's an interesting place of agreement that's going on. Bear's ears seems to me that the bear always has two ears with very different sides of view, and different people want different things. But there's a land swap going on that's backed by tribes, it's backed by governments, it's backed by just about everyone. There seems to be an odd amount of agreement. So there's going to be a swapping going on where Utah gets some land, and there's something for everyone. So who truly understands this and what's going to happen? Mara, Candace, who knows what's happening here?
We just took a vote on this in our last session. It's HR 3049 is the resolution, but essentially we okayed this land swap. Yeah. And why it matters is when Bear's Ears was established, and we can agree to disagree or, you know, whatever you want on how we name national monuments and how that happens. But when they did that, it locked up 160,000-plus acres of Utah land within that. And we have, obviously with Utah, we have SITLA, Utah School Institutional Trust Lands Administration. And they worked with our congressional delegation to get to a place where we could swap land that was locked up within there in other places in the state that will bring millions of dollars into our public education system. So I do think this is it. You know, we're taking what was not a great situation and trying to make the best out of it. But yeah, we did take a vote of support in the legislature recently.
So what I think is interesting about this issue, and I want to call out Representative John Curtis, because mm-hmm. the devil is in the details here. Like, you're right. There was consensus. There wasn't a partisan fight necessarily about the land swap.
Yeah.
But when you're moving that many individual parcels, suddenly there's complexity. Mm-hmm. And so you have to give credit to Curtis's office for leading this really complex set of contractual relationships. And partly because there was a Republican will in this, there was an argument to be made that some of the state land that was within now the new the protected boundaries, mm-hmm. what you were losing in addition to access, you were losing access to using natural resources, mm-hmm. to extracting natural resources. So not only did the state of Utah sort of want an equivalent parcel someplace else, they wanted a similar production of that parcel.
The value of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Which
and
makes
so the,
sense.
So it wasn't mm-hmm. like, I need, you have 10 acres, I want 10 acres. It was more like, here's, not all of it has extraction, but some of it did. And then you also had an equity issue in which the county in which it was coming from and the proximate counties, if you had just, you know, given it all to Northern Utah, they would be like, what? Mm-hmm. We only have so much land and you gave away ours, because there is a relationship between the local school districts and the benefit that they have. So while you had this high level consensus, we should not minimize right. how many, like, I can't remember, I think it's like 10 different counties have dozens of individual parcels yeah. that had to be identified, decided who is going, yeah, assessed, decided the use, decided the value, and to bring it to that point was pretty remarkable. And then John Curtis was able to explain a unique Western situation yeah. to Congress and say, we have consensus, we want to do this. And the net impact of this will be, for those of us who like Bears Ears and appreciate the protections, it's a rare moment where people can applaud that. And those who want to support CITLA and support and keep healthy the extraction industries, they got to win too. Like, this was a really well done settlement.
Yeah, and there were some rural counties in Utah, because this isn't something that my brain's usually thinking about, but my mother-in-law, who passed a couple years ago, lived in Monticello, and so we were dealing with some property down there when Bears Ears, kind of everything stuck, and there were some people, you know, a lot of people who'd kind of moved into the area getting ready for extraction or whatnot, and then all of a sudden those jobs or possibilities of jobs disappeared, and then people were like, okay, well, who's going to be in our schools next year, and can we sell these homes and stuff? So that kind of uncertainty, I think, is stressful for communities, and yeah. I guess having answers and knowing and all the money.
And the yo-yo yeah. effect it creates from administration to administration yeah. on increasing, decreasing. And you know, I would say we were not a fan of having the Bears Ears Monument designated, but this is taking a bad situation and trying to make it better, and that's where I think Representative Curtis does a good job at saying, like, I get that we're upset, but what can we do to fix a piece of this? And, and that's where I think it's really helpful for CITLA especially.
All right. Congratulations to Congressman Curtis's office, because it does sound very complicated, and there were a lot of people who had to agree and get on the same page for that. So good stuff there. One thing that I don't think anyone's on the same page with, the U.S. House voted to send articles of impeachment against President Biden to the Judiciary and Homeland Security Committees, which is sort of a sideways way of voting about this. I think it was kind of Boebert who brought it up yesterday. But interestingly enough, all four of our Utah congressional leaders voted that it actually would go to those committees and be heard. So that's happening. I don't know if there's actually any presidents who haven't had articles of impeachment in recent decades filed against them. So here we are.
I feel like it's a requirement now.
Yeah.
impeach the opposite body.
A massive hammer.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And so it's a super bummer, too, because you don't gasp anymore. Like, I feel like 20 years ago, I was like, now I'm like oh,
Clinton.
Any
With
given
Clinton,
Tuesday.
Yeah, that was
right. And you knew minute by minute everything. And now we're like, oh, I will say what our listeners already know is this is step one of many. And I think you will find even Republicans starting to differentiate and weigh in on this issue. So both sides are equally culpable for, well, you did that to me last week, and
yes.
oh, you did that to me 2 weeks ago. So they both have troubles there. But I think as you see this process unfurl, I think who will shine as statesmen, I believe, will be the Republicans, actually, on this issue.
It'll be interesting to see, because we were talking about Clinton, and as soon as you said that, my brain was thinking, it depends on what the definition of is. You know, there's like lines that stick out to you, you know, that you remember forever from these things, and I think the rest of the world probably watches us and is thinking, get it together, guys.
I teach American government, and when we talked about the U.S. presidency and impeachment, I said, I know you hear this word a lot, but this is actually the nuclear bomb. Like, this is a big deal, and And with that, I mean, it was down party lines, the vote, and it was on to send it to a committee, right? Yes. It was largely driven by Representative Bobera and Marjorie Green Taylor, I believe. So a committee can sit on a bill indefinitely.
Indefinitely, yeah.
Anyways, now that's not to say that there aren't unfounded frustrations at the border, and that's what they were building this based off of. But yeah, I do think we'll have to see what happens or doesn't happen in terms of the support to push this any further.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is the federal focus in the last few weeks, everyone's been watching former President Trump in court and what's going to happen there. Mm-hmm. And is that fair? And should Biden be looked at in charge in the same ways? Should Clinton in the past retrospect the same? And now we're moving forward to another case that's got everyone up in arms. And that's the Hunter Biden plea deal that came out this week. It's a deal where prosecutors announced that Hunter will be pleading guilty to two tax misdemeanors. We're learning out of some congressional hearings coming out that there was a possibility of maybe more felonies, up to 11 charges that were not filed. And so that brings up the question of, is there a two-tier justice system, Mara? Are we treating him differently because he's Hunter Biden or name, let's say, Donald Trump's kids or whoever you want to be mad about? Would they be tried differently than someone who would have those same problems with taxes, same problems with guns, and they would probably spend a couple of years in prison for it?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, yes, we're absolutely treating Hunter Biden and Trump differently. We're treating all wealthy, entitled Americans. The justice system disproportionately likes wealth because wealth can defend itself and they have means. So let's first give a shout out to average Americans and minorities who are not treated fairly under the justice system. But having said that, are Hunter Biden and Trump both the cause of their problems? For sure. And I don't think, and is there a political motivation in both cases? For sure. But did they do it? For sure. I mean, or, you know, we don't know what it is, but they have played with the line. So what I would argue, though, is when we say, are we treating them differently, I would not suggest they're being treated poorly. I would suggest that the heat is on them because of their actions and because of their profile and because their title. I will differentiate that. If you are a president in the United States, I hope you're held to a higher. I expect that of you. It's a position of trust. And Hunter Biden's sentencing was actually in par with most of these sentences. I do think what's being conflated a little bit is his issues that he has around his laptop are yet to come. And those are more serious, and they have higher consequences. This was a tax evasion. I mean, these were sort of pretty delineated, and he was given sort of an average. And I think it's worth noting, though, I don't want to keep conflating Hunter Biden and Trump because I actually think they both deserve their own path of judgment there. But I will say, the case against Trump is not about having top security items in your home. It's about evasion and obstruction, right? It's not that. So what he shares in common with Mike Pence and Biden and Hillary is this, like, hey, y'all, are you paying any attention? The differentiation is how they responded and who initiated that, not whether they had documents.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone asked for Hillary's back, but I think there may have been a hammer involved there where she smashed some stuff up. So a different kind of bad, but yeah.
I feel like Hunter Biden's getting a slap on the wrist for something that if an average American citizen had evaded taxes for multiple years consecutively, hundreds of thousands of dollars, was in possession of a firearm when they shouldn't have been, I do feel like he's getting off pretty clean. And, you know, when you do a comparison, I know now they have, like, the celebrity rap sheets where they go through. Jail time is actually not uncommon for that level of tax evasion and coupled with the other things that he's being charged with. I know he took a plea deal on this. But, and so, yeah, that's a huge issue. But I also think what is incredibly damaging is when everyday Americans see that, it erodes even more trust in our institutions and our justice system, because they see themselves and say, there's no way, one, I could pay an attorney to get me that kind of sweetheart deal, and two, that I would be treated that way in a court. So I think that's where a lot of the frustration comes from. I listened to C-SPAN. I'm one of those people.
And I love it because they do a Democrat and a Republican, and you hear both sides. But I was really surprised when they made this announcement. And right after President Biden said, he was asked about it, he said, I'm very proud of my son. And I felt like that probably could have been nuanced a little better. It's one thing as a parent to be defensive of your child, but to say, like, yeah, my kids made mistakes and we're moving forward. Probably would have been a better statement. But, like, just buckling down on, I'm very proud of my kid, and it just comes off even more tone deaf when you're looking at the situation. But to the point made, the House Oversight Committee is going to continue doing what they're doing. House Republicans are going to continue their investigations, and I think that's where you'll have even more damning findings come forward, and we'll see what happens with that.
A couple of points I would sort of very much disagree on is that that's a little out of context. The question to the Bidens was asked to comment about his sentencing.
Right.
And they said, essentially, no, we're taking a pass on that, and the only thing we're going to say about our kids is that we're proud of them. So the context of knowing he said, I am not speaking to that, he didn't say it.
His press secretary
as
had said that,
a response.
And then he came and
right.
Said
yeah. But I think
cuff.
In fairness, we knew what he was saying. I am not speaking to that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a little unfair treatment. The other thing is, statistically, actually, Hunter Biden is being held more in account. It is less likely for us. There are, there's about 11% of Americans who aren't paying their taxes. And it is incredibly rare that anyone will ever be held accountable for that. And the lost revenue. I mean, remember, we had this under a Trump administration where, rightly so, he was saying, let's go after lost revenue from tax evaders. They're not this rich and this bougie about it. I mean, I think there's a total indictment of Hunter Biden's approach to the world and lifestyle that I would join the chorus that says, geez, this guy doesn't seem to have much personal accountability.
Yeah.
So I'm not defending him, but statistically, he actually is in a rare group of people that is being held accountable for a misdemeanor crime. I'm not excusing that behavior, but this notion that he's getting off, I don't think, is actually backed by the statistics of the IRS.
Speaking of Hunter, random thing, but last night I noticed, and tell me what you think about this. So obviously he's facing other issues with his laptop or Burisma, or questions about mm-hmm. whether he had undue influence with other governments or businesses because of his dad. I can see if you're a dad and you're proud of your kid that you would have him over for Sunday dinner, which would be awesome at the White House. It's like a cool party at the White House on Sunday nights. But I thought it was interesting that he was invited to the state dinner, because it sort of is a statement, too, that yeah. he still belongs in those circles where you have all these powerful, rich, influential people around that belong to other governments and businesses. And so I was like, oh, that's an interesting decision.
Not to jump sides, but this is to Candace's point, where you do say to the Bidens, okay, fine. Love your kids. But is this the right?
Come
and
on.
The other thing is, he's a grown-up, right? He's 52 years old, or however
yeah.
old he is.
It's
not like you're
11-year-old
where you're
exactly.
like,
yeah.
like the Obamas or the Clintons who actually had children
yeah.
in the White House.
So my kid had
man.
A party. I'm
yeah.
sorry. She's, whatever. So you do wonder.
You can say, hey, hun, you're not going to be coming to the White House for a while
yeah.
because you are just yeah. all sorts of bad news for us right
yeah.
now.
And then just to add a totally non-relevant fact, but for some reason I thought it was hilarious to walk down memory lane. What someone had pulled the list of other like really bad relatives of presidents.
Yeah.
And so you went through, remember Ronald Reagan, which now seems so tame, but remember his daughter spoke out against some of his policies, which at the time was
like what?
Holy Toledo. And then she,
TikTok didn't
she
exist
was
back then.
In Playboy. And again, I mean, these are weirdly tame now, but the one I had forgotten that I was like, wow, is Billy Carter, when President Carter was in office, took $200,000 from Libya.
What?
And apparently in cash. And he goes out to later say it was a loan, which is but from Libya, not. Right. And so to President Carter's credit, and I'm paraphrasing because President Carter's genteel, but he essentially stands up and is like, I got nothing here. My brother is a loser and I have no control and he shouldn't have done it.
But
and I'm so sorry.
People respect that.
See,
as
I
opposed
like that
to
honesty.
Covering it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But I had forgotten good old Billy Carter took $200,000 from Libya.
And I do think that you have to leave people's children or their spouses alone because they didn't choose to run for these offices. But when we get into the last few years of politics where adult children are involved, then I'm like, they're adults. They probably should have
Plus,
to be
President
held to account.
Biden's been in politics longer than I've been alive. Like, I'm 31 years old, and the dude's been around forever. His kids grew up in this environment.
Yeah.
And it is a privileged world, right? You're introduced, and you're networking with people you probably wouldn't interact with at a state's dinner otherwise, right? But I do think on this, it is just another chink in the armor of where people feel like this is not fair. You know, regardless of your party affiliation, and there are a couple IRS whistleblowers who have come forward who said, we did recommend felony charges. And so I think that's where when you have that information out there, it does feel like a slap on the
but
wrist.
But it does speak to the dynasty issue that we have in America, where these generations of power families, and you even see this with both parties' nominations, where you're like, I'm pretty sure that was the same list from so-and-so ago. And we do need to ask ourselves, what I love, love, love about local politics, I used to be a huge fan of term limits. But if you look at the Utah State Legislature, it turns over about every 3 years. Not completely, not totally, but like we have a good
Fresh
bit
blood.
Of turnaround. So like you don't need to regulate that. But you do have to regulate, and there's a now there's this whole logic stream where if someone gets in the Senate, you're not even meaningful until, you know, I don't know,
until you're like 75.
So we've got to figure out how to freshen up, which is part of, I think, our own complaint about we see the new list of people and we're like, oh my gosh, haven't we been talking about these same people forever?
For and ever.
But I think Biden and Bush and the Clintons, and I'm not speaking to the fact that they're not high-quality people, maybe, but too long is too long for even high-quality people.
Robert Kennedy would tell you that the Kennedy name is not doing him any good right now.
That's
so,
for sure.
Yes.
And that's why I'm excited about a lot of the names who are jumping in to run for president who are Republicans. Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott. We have some great people running who are fresh ideas, and we don't need to turn back as a party. We need to be moving forward, and so I really am looking forward to this race moving forward. And it is amazing the rate at which we reelect incumbents. It's above 90%.
Yeah.
And so we have to take a hard look.
Yeah. And speaking of that, we are out of time, but I forget what it's called, the Faith Something Summit that's going on this weekend with the presidential candidates. I actually heard a few speeches coming out of there from Chris Christie, from the former Vice President Pence, and a few others. And I was like, oh, these actually sound sort of uplifting to hear. So it was kind of nice. Yes.
Yeah.
Former President Trump's tomorrow. We'll see if it sticks on with that. But it's interesting. It's an interesting time to be alive. So thank you for weighing in on Ladies Week here. Candace
this was
and Mara.
Fun.
Yeah, very
Thanks
good.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back next week to see exactly what the heck happens at in Delta, Utah this weekend. Only fun things. Thanks for joining us.